Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Long-term effects of concussions and other head injuries have been getting a lot of attention recently, especially in athletes of all levels and ages. My guest today is neuropsychologist Dr. Robert Stern, who is co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. Our topic will be the very latest research on traumatic brain injuries. You can reach us today with your questions and comments throughout the next hour. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. Let me give you that one again, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Stern, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, it is completely my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Dr. Woodard.
Dr. Stern is joining us by telephone from, where are you? You're back in Boston or New York?
Yeah, I don't even know these days where I am. I think I'm in Newark, New Jersey.
Okay.
I'm at a meeting.
All right. Well, let's get into things. I like to start with a little basics, and it's very difficult to talk about anatomy and physiology without videos and pictures, but could we talk a little bit about the pertinent parts of the brain that's going to relate to what we're talking about today?
Sure thing. You know, I think it's real important for people first to understand that the brain is a relatively soft, gelatinous kind of material that is surrounded by fluid, spinal fluid, and surrounding that is our hard, rock-like skull. And the brain itself is made up of billions of different cells, the neurons, which are the key part that carry all of our information from one cell to another and do all of the work that we do. And then there's some additional cells that help out the neurons working. And there's lots and lots of different parts of the brain that come together in this intricate way that make us who we are, that make us human beings. You know, I think it's hard for people to truly understand, to truly comprehend what the brain does, but it's everything from memory to language to movement to music to emotions to smell to personality even. And so this brain inside our skull is this most magnificent organ of ours. And perhaps for today's conversation, there's a couple parts of the brain that I think are worthwhile talking about. One is the frontal lobes, and parts of the frontal lobes are responsible for things like organization and planning and multitasking and judgment and decision making and kind of putting a lid on things, you know, making us stop those impulses from coming up. And then another area is the deep part, or what's called the medial part of the temporal lobes. Those are the parts of the brain kind of right inside your ears. And that part of the brain is responsible for memory. There's a part called the hippocampus that makes us learn new things. And another part called the amygdala, which is responsible for things like emotions and rage and impulses. And then all of those parts of the brain are connected through this intricate kind of weaving of connections between all those billions of cells. And it's those long connections between cells, or the axons, that are also critical to talk about in this discussion.
And they are the information is transferred from cell to cell along these axon and connections, which we've talked about before in the program, called dendrites. So that's the active part of this brain that we're dealing with. Is that right?
That's right. The cell body is kind of the bulk of it that kind of has all the important chemicals and juices in it, and it sends those chemicals from one cell to another through the axons, and they jump across something called a synapse and into the dendrite of another cell.
All right. Perhaps the next thing we ought to define and discuss briefly is a concussion, which I think most listeners have certainly heard about or heard of. But let's define it, and in particular, I'd like to talk about asymptomatic concussion to make sure that one's discussed as well.
Yep. So, you know, this is probably one of the most misunderstood and misused terms, concussion. Let me start off by getting rid of one of the long-held myths that if it's a concussion, it means you've lost consciousness, you've blacked out, and that is not true at all. A very, very small percentage of concussions actually lead to a loss of consciousness. So what is a concussion? Give you a kind of a formal definition first. It's a temporary change to the functioning of the brain cells caused by mechanical force to the head or the body that moves that brain around, resulting in an alteration in mental status and related symptoms and signs. In other words, when you get your head or your body quickly hit, the brain then moves around inside that hard skull. And remember, it's surrounded by that cerebrospinal fluid. So it kind of jostles around, it jiggles around in there. And that sudden movement and the kind of acceleration and then the rapid deceleration or the rotational forces of that brain stretch and shear and do some temporary damage to those axons that we were talking about. And it's that temporary change of those brain cells that cause the symptoms. What's important to know is that a concussion is, by definition, a non-structural injury, meaning it's not a bruise to the brain. You can't see it on routine scans of the brain. But rather what it is it's this sudden change to the functioning of the individual nerve cells, with different chemicals going in and out of the cells when they shouldn't be. I mean, there's a change in the amount of sugar metabolism in the cells. There's a change in the amount of blood flow around that area of the brain. And all of that results in this temporary change in the axonal functioning of the brain.
So that many of the typical studies that we might do, an MRI or CT scans that people have heard of, really would generally, in particularly in concussion, would not show anything, is what I'm hearing. So this is kind of in the microscopic level.
That's right. But it's important for your listeners to know that if they have a pretty big hit to the head and they're very symptomatic, they should be seen by a physician right away or perhaps go to the emergency room, because there are times when a scan can or should be done to rule out something else, right, like a hemorrhage in the brain, you know, subdural hematoma, and those things definitely need to be seen immediately, emergently, by a scan. But the typical concussion is something that is very subtle, and the symptoms of it can be anything from having a headache to feeling in a fog to having nausea, double or poor vision, being fatigued, perhaps having poor memory. And so it goes on and on. So when someone feels like they've been dinged, or they see stars, or they've gotten their bell rung after having their head hit, that indeed is a concussion. And again, very few concussions actually lead to a loss of consciousness.
Okay. Just before we leave the imaging thing, a question maybe more for me and my editorial prerogative here. Are there investigational scans, and I'm beginning to think about functional MRI, PET scans, which is not necessarily investigational, anything where we are beginning to have an ability to see what's going on at the cellular level with concussion?
That's a great question. It seems to be the holy grail right now is to be able to come up with some kind of objective way of diagnosing a concussion with scans or electrophysiological measures or you name it. And really right now there isn't a good investigational approach for the immediate diagnosis of the concussion.
Okay. And then let's go next to just a brief discussion about the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. What are you all doing? What's particularly different, perhaps, about what you're doing compared to other centers?
Sure. Well, our center started around 3.5 years ago, and it was the merging of two individual groups, one called the Sports Legacy Institute, or SLI, which was founded by Dr. Robert Cantu, a world-famous neurosurgeon and concussion expert, and Mr. Chris Nowinski, who I'll tell you about in more detail in a second. And Chris was a former athlete. And they created this organization, a nonprofit, called Sports Legacy Institute, to raise the awareness and to educate the world about the dangers of sports-related brain trauma. But they, when they were beginning, they were starting to look at some deceased athletes who they wanted to have their brains examined after they passed away by someone who knew how to really look at the brains of people with a perhaps a long-term disease from hitting their heads. And that led them to communicate with our group at Boston University School of Medicine because we have one of the Alzheimer's disease centers in the country. The National Institutes of Health fund around 29 centers of excellence dealing with Alzheimer's disease, and us, we at BU have one of those things. And so I run the clinical research program at the BU Alzheimer's Disease Center, which means I oversee the research having to do with people while they're alive, diagnosing and treating Alzheimer's disease. And I have a colleague, Dr. Anne McKee, who's a neuropathologist, and she's one of the leading neuropathologists internationally having to do with diseases of the brain, and especially Alzheimer's disease and related types of diseases. And so we decided to merge. We created this formal affiliation between Sports Legacy Institute and the Boston University School of Medicine with Dr. McKee and me as the co-directors from BU, and Dr. Cantu and Chris Nowinski as the co-directors from SLI. And so we've had now this center for the last 3.5 years. And our goal is to try to understand the long-term effects of repetitive brain trauma in athletes. And by that, we specifically focus on a disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE.
Before we get to that, let's mention the other programs that you're doing, or the programs that you're, the research programs that are underway there that other listeners may want to even participate in.
Sure. Well, as part of our center, we do a variety of different types of studies trying to help us understand what happens down the road after someone has had experience of repetitive brain trauma from various types of sports. And we're talking not just professional athletes, but people who participated in high school sports or college sports or professional. And we're not just looking for people who have hit their head and had symptomatic concussions or brain trauma. We're looking for the wide spectrum of that. And so one way people can help our research is by participating in our brain donation registry, which means people can sign up prior to death and agree to donate their brains after they die. We definitely don't want them before they die. We want people to plan ahead, and after they pass away, their family members would then also know that the individual wanted to donate their brains for research, so we can study all different types of brains and different past experiences. And then another way related to that is to get involved in what we call our LEGEND study, which is a great acronym for a long title that I can never remember the name of our own acronyms. But the LEGEND study is a longitudinal or a follow-up kind of study that's only done by telephone, so people don't have to come by to Boston. Your listeners in the Anchorage area could participate in a study like this, where we examine people by phone and on the web every year of their life. So it's a way for us to see the kind of course of someone's symptoms and look at their history all through their life. And we do things like measure their cognitive functioning, memory, intention, things like that on the phone, find out things about their sports history and the number of hits they took to their head. We have them fill out a bunch of forms having to do with things like depression and impulse control. And the people who are interested can also spit into a special tube, and that gets sent to us so we can look at DNA and look at various genes that might be associated with these long-term problems associated with repetitive brain trauma.
All right. So let's now talk about this chronic encephalopathy of the brain and what we mean there, and particularly what are we finding when we look at the brain?
So let's go back to that whole issue of concussions.
Okay.
And remember that the concussion is when you hit your head and you have symptoms. Sometimes someone can hit their head, and the same problem can occur on that neuronal level, that cellular level, but someone might not have symptoms. And we refer to that as subconcussive blows or subconcussive injuries. And because, you know, people complain about different things at different levels, and because some people don't like reporting whether they've had a concussion because they want to be macho or they don't want to, you know, be pulled from a game or whatever, one of the things we found is that it's real important to look at the overall amount of hits to the head someone's had. And so if you think about, let's say, a lineman in football, hits their head against their opponent every play of every game and every practice. And that can result in around 1,000 to 1,500 hits to the head, and therefore hits to the brain, every year. And those hits have been measured by fancy gizmos inside the helmets, and they can amount to around 20 to 25 G every hit. That's kind of the equivalent of driving a car into a brick wall at around 30 miles per hour, each one of those. And so if you think of it, 1,000 to 1,500 hits to the head with the brain moving around, each one of them, might not be good for you. And that's one of the things that we have found. And so if we think about concussions and these repetitive subconcussive hits, what happens in some people, but not all, is that later on in life, they develop a progressive, or we at least think it's progressive, brain disease, a neurodegenerative disease called CTE. And CTE is similar to Alzheimer's disease, but it's a completely unique disease. And so it starts earlier in life. Somehow it gets started because of the repetitive blows to the brain. And that sets in motion this cascade of events in the brain cells and around the brain cells that lead to an accumulation of an abnormal form of a protein called tau inside the brain cells. And that accumulation of that protein winds up destroying the brain cells as the disease progresses. And as more and more brain cells stop functioning or die off, the symptoms begin. And so the symptoms of CTE usually don't start for years or decades after the person stopped hitting their head, and then continues through the rest of life.
Let me take just a second to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our topic today is the result of chronic injury to the head. My guest today is Dr. Robert Stern. He's a neuropsychologist and co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. If you have questions or comments or experiences you'd like to share, please give us a call today at 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address during the next hour is line1@alaskapublic.org. there's a tendency from my mind to go to the areas that are injured and the tau protein, and realizing what happens with Alzheimer's is there's a lot of correlation there, and certainly you have experience with Alzheimer's as well as this chronic encephalopathy related to head injury. Is there more to it than that? Is it give us any hints about the origins of either one of these not completely understood diseases?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of the really interesting things for me as a scientist to be able to study CTE is that it's going to also help us understand these other related diseases like Alzheimer's disease. And so as an Alzheimer's researcher, I'm now very excited about being able to study CTE. And as a CTE researcher, I'm able to exploit what we've learned over the last several years about Alzheimer's disease. Now, we've known about Alzheimer's for the last 108 years, and we still don't really know what causes it. We still can't prevent it. We still can't cure it. And we don't even have a meaningful way of diagnosing it during life at this point. And so we've been studying it with the most incredible neuroscientists around for so long, and we're finally, in the last few years, making inroads in all of those areas. We're finally understanding how to diagnose Alzheimer's before someone dies, instead of having to wait to look at their brains. We're finally understanding what goes on in the brain to create the changes in the brain. And all of those things are allowing us to learn more quickly about CTE. But also, we're going to be able to learn a lot about Alzheimer's disease and other related diseases by being able to study this other disease called CTE, because with CTE, we at least know what causes it, or we at least know the necessary variable that causes it. So, with CTE, it's important, I think, for your listeners to know that repetitive blows to the head are a necessary variable for causing this disease later in life. But that's not sufficient. In other words, not everyone who's hit their head over and over again is going to develop this progressive degenerative disease. But everyone who's ever had a confirmed diagnosis of CTE at autopsy, so every case of CTE in the world's literature and in our hands at our center at BU with Dr. McKee, everyone has had a history of repetitive brain trauma. So that's how we know that you need that necessary ingredient of repetitive brain trauma earlier in life to develop this disease. But now what we're trying to figure out is, why does one person get it and another person not get it? What are those other variables, like genetics and other things, that might cause one person to get it and prevent another person from getting it?
And we do have a number of calls coming in now, but one of the other factors appears to be, from what you're implying earlier, is that the number of hits and at least the amount of force related to those numbers may also be, although maybe we don't know for sure, a significant risk factor.
Yeah, and we just don't know yet all of those things. We're at such an infancy in the area of CTE and our knowledge of CTE that we still have all of those things to figure out.
Okay. Well, let's take a couple of calls. Tina, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I had a concussion. That's how it was diagnosed. I was in a car accident back in October. It's my 6-month anniversary afterwards now. And I've always just referred to it as a concussion, which I recognize is a very serious thing on its own. But I did lose consciousness, and I did have amnesia both before and after, events that happened the month before even, I can't remember. And the MRI showed nothing, and I've lost a lot of my words and my vocal speaking, my speaking skills and stuff, and it's just been very hard. And is there a time frame that we can, I know it depends on the person, but it's just, the dizziness still happens on occasion, and it's not been an easy road, of course.
Yeah, Tina, you're describing something that is so common and so frustrating. It does sound like you had a concussion or a mild traumatic brain injury, and it's definitely on the the more serious side of a concussion. You did lose consciousness, you did have all that amnesia, and you still have residual problems 6 months later. There's no, like you said, there's no easy way of looking into the future and saying when things are going to get better on a case-by-case basis. It's really so individual. And it's probably important for you to continue to be followed by your medical team and perhaps continue in any rehabilitation that you've been in. But there really is no way of looking into the crystal ball and saying what's going to get better and how fast it's going to get better. But keep plugging because these things do get better.
Okay, and essentially I was kind of let go after the medical diagnosis. I mean, I'm uninsured, of course, so but nobody really pursued me for follow-up treatments. And plus I'm 58, I'm going to be 59 in a few weeks, and I'm wondering how it's getting difficult to separate aging from concussion.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm wondering, is there, you know, should I be doing something? Should I be doing brain exercises or seeing someone to work on this, or just is it a matter of time?
Yeah, you know, I do recommend if you can somehow see someone who might be able to work around the financial stuff to make sure that you're checked out to see what your current strengths and weaknesses are. In terms of the normal aging stuff, you know, we all, I think, follow a myth that as we get older, we lose our cognitive abilities. And in fact, we don't really. You know, nothing really significant happens as we age. We have some mild things, but 58, 59, that's pretty darn young. And if you are still experiencing some of the things that were more serious after the brain injury, then it may still be that. And so if you can find someone who can look into it and examine you and perhaps recommend some rehabilitation techniques, that would be great.
Okay, and what kind of someone should I be looking for?
Yeah, I would probably start with a family practitioner or a general practice. And, you know, there are neuropsychiatrists, neuropsychologists that perhaps they might refer you to get some of that baseline. Is that appropriate, Dr. Stern?
Definitely. Always good to start with your family practitioner or primary care physician.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
You bet.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Jim, you're on line one.
Good afternoon.
Yep. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a lot of these problems. I'm a white male adult, 70 years old, and I spent most of my life in several careers in Lancy and Air Rescue. I've taken almost every kind of a hit, including misparked airplanes and skiing off cliffs into a pile of stumps and two car wrecks. The big thing, I think, though, is that I also spent 6 years driving little bitty patrol search and rescue trooper boats here in Alaska in choppy waters. So after 16 hours a day for half of that year, I'm like a bobble-headed doll on your dashboard. I do have an appointment day after tomorrow with a neuropsychologist here in Anchorage, and I never heard of CTE, but I am having the dysfunctions of occasional speech, balance, vision change, hearing, loss of words, and I'm reputed to be a wordsmith. So I'd like to know what you can tell me about this. I find your program also very interesting. Thank you, doctors. Right. I'll take my response off the air.
All right, Jim. Thanks.
Now, Jim, it's an amazing story of experience that you have had with your head being kind of shaken up throughout your whole life in many different ways. And yeah, you know, the brain doesn't know what's hurting it. You know, the brain can't detect whether it's from boxing, which was the original cause of CTE that people thought about for years when they referred to it as dementia pugilistica or punch drunk, or whether it's going up and down on the choppy waters and having your bobblehead kind of move that brain around. The brain is being moved, and we don't know for sure what is enough of that movement, what is enough of that subtle brain trauma to result in this disease. For you to learn something more about CTE, perhaps before you see the psychologist you're going to see, you could go visit our website. Dr. Woodard, I gather you have it on your
yeah.
website, but it's www.bu.edu/CSTE. And there you can learn more about what CTE is and read some of our papers, and there's some good lay descriptions of things as well.
That's a very good suggestion, and I'll also mention that alaskapublic.org will get you to Line 1, and on today's program there are links to a couple of places at the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy, both the site that Dr. Stern gave, plus a site on some case studies on several athletes, some CDC literature, and then a couple of videos that would help anyone who wants to know more about the program or about this process. We're about halfway through. I need to take a short break at this time. We're going to take a very short one, and then we'll be right back. But let me remind everybody, this is Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. You can call us at 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take this short break, and we'll continue to take calls and any emails as we talk with neuropsychologist Dr. Robert Stern, co-director of the Center for Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston School of Medicine. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is latest research on traumatic brain injuries. Our guest is neuropsychologist Dr. Robert Stern, who's co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University School of Medicine. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. That's for your emails. Our direct line in Anchorage is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And for those of you in our neighborhood, just remember that if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a recorded message in our program and won't be able to answer your questions at that time. Before we get to a couple of callers who've been patiently holding on, I'd like to also ask about some of the information that's been, or the request for information before these injuries happen to help people like yourself understand it more. There are now, as I understand it, many schools, both high school, college levels, professional, that are doing some pre-injury, I should say, studies, or getting some baseline neuropsychological studies that we can compare later, which would help us, as I see it, to understand perhaps a little bit more about the kinds of people who are susceptible and the kind of injuries that might lead to the chronic encephalopathy.
Yeah, what you're referring to typically is called baseline testing, and it's used anywhere from the pros, and including the NFL, NHL, all the way down to some youth hockey or football or soccer teams, and many high schools now include it or make it mandatory, and almost all colleges do. And what it is it's a computerized test that's done prior to a season or prior to the person starting to get their head hit. So there can be this baseline measurement of how the person's brain is working in terms of reaction time and memory and attention, things like that. And then if the person is hit and seems to have symptoms of a concussion, the doctor or the athletic trainer or the school nurse can then readminister the test to see if the person is back to their baseline functioning. Or if they're not, if they're showing a decrement after the injury compared to what they were like before, then it's probably too early to return to play. But there are a lot of pros and a lot of cons to that whole approach. Concussion, as I was describing earlier, is really a clinical diagnosis. It's not just one thing. It really needs to be thoroughly looked at and needs to be diagnosed and assessed by someone who really knows what they're talking about. And it's a multifaceted type of diagnosis. It's not just the performance on one of these computerized cognitive tests, but it's definitely an important part of the overall assessment. It definitely helps to have this baseline to compare it to. But there's a few little things that your listeners should know about this type of testing. The most common test is called IMPACT, but there's several other tests used out there for this type of baseline and repeat testing. One of the problems with it is that kids of all ages have learned to not do well at baseline. They learn to kind of cheat the test. And so once they get hit, they're not going to look like they're that much worse or worse at all because they've done poorly at baseline. And they do that because they want to make sure they don't lose any playing time. They don't want to be kicked off or made to rest longer. So it looks like they haven't shown any decline. Now, the tests are being improved all the time to pick up on this cheating aspect of it, but still some kids know how to do that. The other thing is that just because someone returns to normal on this one part of their area of functioning, this one cognitive assessment, doesn't mean that they are ready to return to activities. They could still have a headache. They could still be feeling in a fog. They could still have lots of things that are symptoms from the concussion that requires the person to rest. Now, what's important is that with rest and with recovery, the symptoms of concussion will resolve. But rest means both physical and cognitive. And for a lot of the teens out there or preteens who are athletes, you try to get them to not do anything like texting or doing video games or watching TV. It's really hard, but it is so critical during that time after the concussion to completely rest and then to return in a stepwise kind of fashion to all types of activities in order to make sure that the symptoms don't return and that you don't prolong the problems. And I recommend your listeners check out the website at the Centers for Disease Control. If they just Google CDC and sports concussion, there are some great things out there at the CDC for parents, for athletes, for coaches, for trainers, and a whole set of tools for physicians as well to use in the diagnosis and management of concussion. But remember, concussions are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this disease we're looking at of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's not just caused by those symptomatic concussions. It's caused by those subconcussive blows as well. And so even in the person who doesn't have symptoms of concussion or that may never have shown any problems on that impact testing, they still might be hitting their head over and over again enough to eventually lead to this disease.
Okay, Gene, you're on line one. You've been waiting patiently. What can we do for you? Gene, you still with us? Nope, we lost her. Let's go ahead and take the next caller. Ben, you're on line one.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call. I wanted to tease out the differences between repetitive, relatively minor brain insults that might occur in a sport like football, hockey, boxing, versus a more serious traumatic brain injury. So 25 years ago, I was in a horrible mountaineering accident. and suffered a epidural hematoma, was in a coma for a relatively short period of time, something in the 36, 48-hour range, underwent months of therapy to put the pieces back together. And I wanted to get a feeling for my likelihood of developing CTE or Alzheimer's-like symptoms later on in life. As I said, this was 25 years ago, and I'm essentially functional these days, and I don't have any specific complaints. I just wanted to tease apart the difference between the repetitive versus singular brain injury. Thank you very much.
Okay. That's a great question, Ben. Thanks for asking it. It's a big difference. What we seem to know right now is that chronic traumatic encephalopathy does not seem to be caused by a single major brain injury, a moderate or severe traumatic brain injury. We've never seen a case where it's been confirmed neuropathologically after someone dies of someone who did not have other repetitive brain trauma exposure and only had a single moderate to severe brain injury like it sounds like you had, Ben. And so that part of the answer is, we think, pretty straightforward, that CTE appears to be caused by that repetitive mild brain trauma. There have been reports in the literature that a single moderate to severe brain injury can be a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease later in life. And remember, Alzheimer's and CTE are very similar, but I am actually questioning that scientific literature these days because none of those studies were prospectively done. They didn't follow people and then see who developed an early type of Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, almost all of those cases never were confirmed kind of biologically, pathologically after they died. And so we don't know whether a lot of that risk for later on Alzheimer's was actually risk for CTE. We just don't know. So it's an open question at this point whether a single brain trauma can lead to anything later on in terms of one of these neurodegenerative diseases. But we're pretty confident that it does not lead to CTE.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right, Ben, thanks for your call. Reminder, listeners, one more time, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Robert Stern. If you've got questions or comments about traumatic brain injuries, particularly the chronic kind that we are discussing that's being investigated now, the chronic injury related to head trauma, give us a call. 550-8433 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Again, at alaskapublic.org, you can get a link to the CDC website that Dr. Stern has mentioned, as well as other websites for more information.
If I could, I think I promised your listeners at the very beginning that I was going to say something about Chris Nowinski, who's one of our four co-directors, and he's the guy who started Sports Legacy Institute, and I think it's an interesting story, and it will help us understand some of the distinctions about the different types of brain trauma.
Good.
Chris Nowinski was a Harvard undergraduate, got his degree from Harvard, was magna cum laude, you know, brilliant guy, and he was also a football player at Harvard, an Ivy League defensive tackle, real kind of superstar. And he then became the first and only Ivy League graduate to join the WWE, the professional wrestling thing. And I hate to break it to your listeners, but indeed that professional wrestling thing is indeed fake, in that it's scripted. But these are pretty large guys who fall on each other and do nasty things that can't always be perfectly scripted, and they, in fact, get hurt.
And Chris had to retire from his pro wrestling very early in his career because he had just debilitating symptoms of depression, of headaches that were just excruciating, of feeling in a fog, of having memory problems, night terrors. And he went from doctor to doctor to doctor and was not given any answer for why he had these symptoms. And it wasn't until he saw Dr. Robert Cantu, one of our co-directors of our center, who said, "So, Chris, have you ever gotten a concussion?" And he said, "I don't think so." He said, "Chris, have you ever hit your head in any of these sports that you've played and had symptoms?" And he listed the different symptoms that I mentioned earlier. And Chris said, "Oh, yeah, of course, hundreds of times." And, "Chris, did you ever continue to play or continue to work out when you had those symptoms?" And he said, "Sure, that's my career, that's my life." So it turns out Chris had what's called post-concussion syndrome. And post-concussion syndrome is when those concussion symptoms don't go away. They're persistent. And that typically happens when someone didn't rest there and recover their initial concussion immediately. And post-concussion syndrome, though it's awful and it can get in the way of living, really, it is not the same as chronic traumatic encephalopathy, whereas post-concussion syndrome gets better eventually, and those symptoms of concussion get better more quickly. CTE, the symptoms don't start until typically one's 30s or 40s or 50s, and then continue to get worse.
All right. Let's go ahead. We have another caller. I want to take Chris. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have a son with autism. He's 13, and his self-injurious behavior is to smack himself in the head with the back of his hand.
Right.
Pretty substantial. Is that going to be a consideration?
This is an interesting question from a pediatric standpoint because we see a lot of these kids that have very difficult to control self-injurious behavior.
Well, I can tell you that there was a case in the world's literature of a developmentally disordered kid who was a head banger, but I believe it was really hitting his head against a wall, which I think probably causes more G-force repetitively than what your son is experiencing. And that individual did wind up having pathologically confirmed CTE. But that's the only case I've ever heard of. That's the only one in the literature. And again, it was, I believe, hitting the head against the wall repetitively.
I guess it would not be too out of the question in someone who's hitting their head a lot to think about at least a protective helmet of some sort. What do you think about that?
Well, that brings up a very important issue about helmets in general. Helmets cannot do a whole lot to prevent the brain from rattling around inside the skull. So even those really big, hard plastic encasements that are worn in football do really nothing to prevent against concussion or subconcussive hits. They were designed completely for the prevention of skull fractures, and they do a superb job at preventing skull fractures. But the force that the head takes when it's being hit goes right through that skull, and the brain is going to move around. And so it depends on the extent of the head trauma that is being experienced, what a protective headgear can do. So, Chris, for your son, it may be that smacking his head with his hand might actually be helped a little bit with protective headgear, but it's not necessarily going to absorb all that force.
Any other questions, Chris?
No, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. While we're on the preventative side of things, you've mentioned some things that we can do, rest, both physical and cognitive, after episodes of concussion. Anything else preventatively that we need for people to hear about?
Well, it brings up some very, very big issues. We don't know enough about the disease, about CTE, to make any major policy changes that's based on the science. But we can take things a little bit logically. If we know that repetitive brain trauma can, in some people, lead to this disease, then it makes sense then to try to reduce the overall amount of repetitive brain trauma. So a good example that my colleague Chris Nowinski brings up frequently is baseball. And I was a little league coach for many, many years, and I remember being on the side with my team, and I had a clicker, a counter, and I'd count every single pitch that the pitcher would be pitching, and because there's a limit for the number of pitches that a kid can make in a single game and in a single week, because there's a very slight chance of tendonitis and some other orthopedic problems if you overuse that arm. Very small chance. So we do that. We count the number of pitches that a pitcher can do in a given day or a given week for that slight chance. And we do absolutely nothing to count the number of hits to the head that our kids get, the number of traumas to their brain. We drop them off at the specific fields, whether it's football or a hockey rink or whatever, even soccer with heading, we just don't know. And we don't do anything to count the number of times they hit their head. We look at other things to try to make sure our kids are healthy and safe. But when it comes to that most vital organ, that organ that I was describing does everything at the beginning of the show, we never do anything to try to decrease the exposure that it gets to trauma.
So briefly, I have a question back to the headgear, which you make a very good point, which I had not considered and thought about. So basically, I think what I'm hearing is not only with helmets, but other types of headgear, there's not much evidence that those things are really protective against concussive injury.
That's right. There are newer helmets in football that have been created that have the equivalent of shock absorbers in them that are designed to try to absorb some of that G-force before it gets to the skull and therefore through to the brain. But nothing can completely stop that kind of trauma. It doesn't mean we shouldn't strive for the best possible protective headgear, but it means that we can't be taken in by the misconception that we're really protecting our brains by wearing these helmets.
We're in our last 5 minutes, Dr. Stern, and I'd like to ask you, let's expand this a little bit and perhaps even into the military, which we talked about a little bit before we came on the air, and some situations that are beginning to make some sense to us about some of the injuries that our military personnel are having that may be related.
Yeah, you know, as I was saying earlier, the brain doesn't know what's hitting it. And right now, traumatic brain injury is the signature wound of our warriors coming out of Iraq, when we were in Iraq, and continuing in Afghanistan. And those traumatic brain injuries very frequently are caused by blast trauma from those IEDs, those roadside bombs. And so the individual doesn't actually get hit by a bomb, but the special blast waves that travel through the air go through the skull and hurt the brain. And so there are now some cases of individuals who have passed away who were in the Afghanistan and Iraq conflicts who have shown CTE following death. So it brings up a very important concept. One is, do those blast injuries count as repetitive brain trauma? Well, yeah, a lot of our military men and women have exposure to repetitive blast. They aren't pulled from the military theater. They just get back and might then get another blast injury. And a lot of our military personnel have a history of exposure to earlier repetitive brain trauma in athletics. And so we're seeing that these brain injuries are the signature wound, and then we're faced with something also really striking, and that is that more of our military men and women are dying from suicide than they are from the injuries on the physical injuries on the field, the military field. That's pretty scary. And suicide and suicidality are amongst the various symptoms of CTE. We've seen all too many of our athletes who have had CTE die from suicide. So the question that's been raised is whether some of these suicides in our military may indeed be due to exposure to repetitive brain trauma and the development of CTE. It's also been raised whether some of the post-traumatic stress disorder that is seen so much in our current veterans may be associated with CTE. And so we don't have any good answers yet, but it definitely is worthwhile investigating. And in fact, the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration are both very interested in looking at these kind of crossovers between CTE and traumatic brain injury and suicide and post-traumatic stress disorder.
Very interesting. All right, we're in our last couple of minutes, and I think what I'd like to do is have you sum up the important bits of information we want listeners to take away from the program today.
Sure. The one that makes the most sense, I think, to everyone is that getting your head hit isn't good for you, and getting it hit over and over again, even very subtly, might not be good for you, and that it may, in some people, result in a disease later in life that is similar to Alzheimer's disease and can result in some very significant symptoms and eventually dementia. And so we have to think back to our kids, our youth athletes, and try to make sure that we are doing the very best for them. And that doesn't mean getting rid of any of these sports. I'm a big football fan. We don't want to see any of these sports get destroyed. We just want to take the brains much more seriously and take the head out of the sports as much as we possibly can.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to join us from back east. I hope you have a good meeting, and we very much appreciate it again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me and for covering this important issue.
All right. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Those who would like to continue this kind of conversation can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find our links on the website that we've mentioned previously, alaskapublic.org. Depression is a and bipolar illness is a has an impact on about one in every five Americans. The cost of these illnesses are billions of dollars each year in lost productivity. More is spent treating depressive illnesses than in treating cancer, yet half of sufferers don't receive the care they need. Why don't you join us next Monday afternoon when my guest will be Dr. John Greeden. He is the founding chair and president of the National Network of Depression Centers and a former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan. You can learn more Monday, May 7th from 2 to 3 p.m. on KSKA. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.